Okay, we'll assume it's a plane anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they say the exact same spot both times. They're out
there, like I say that. Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
Marlisa,
are you ready for this?
The cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello, and thanks for downloading this podcast, which is edition 434 of Strange Days Indeed, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. This week, the first in April 2007, editorial contributor Dave Verlott, abductee and former assistant to the late Professor Dr. John Mack, head of psychiatry at Harvard University, Will Boucher, and the Dean of Ufology, publisher of the Journal of UFO History, author and researcher Richard Hall. But first up, a couple of years ago, Gary, a listener, sent me a home audio recording of his grandmother, who had a series of strange sightings on a lake near Bob Cajun here in Ontario, Canada. The original was real noisy, but in the ensuing years, software has become available that cleans up audio noise. So it sounds a little whooshy, but here is Gary's grandmother with her report.
This was reported to you by my grandmother, who is just approaching 95 years of age. Not a person to exaggerate. What she tells you here is what she and five other people witnessed.
This was in November. It was around 83 or 84. I just can't remember the year. It was our bingo night. 6:30, we leave. My neighbors, next door neighbors, went to the bingos with it, and they came out. I walked out on the deck, waiting for my husband to lock the side door, and thought, what a beautiful night. It was so still, not a sound, dark, peaceful. My neighbors came out that time. I don't know whether their deck lights were on or not. And I looked towards the lake, and here is what I thought was a fancy yacht parked 30 feet from the house. It was there, and nobody ever heard it come in. Not one sound. And we'd never had anything big come in the bay before. Just rowboat or motorboats like ours, which only 14, 15, 16 feet boats, that sort of thing. Because the water isn't that deep. And there was lights across the top of it. That's all I could see at that point, was these lights. And I tried to look through them to see if somebody was looking at me. But you could see a light, but you couldn't see any forms or anything. It's like a glass brick, 4 or 5 inches square. And there was about 10 or 12 of them across the top of this boat. The lights were colored orange, blue, all the way across. The nose of the boat wasn't sharp. It was rounded, sort of. I couldn't see the other side of it, of course. I just saw the side that was up against our wall, where you would just step out the door of the boat onto the lawn. But there was no doors or regular windows or anything. Nothing. I looked quickly around the lawn to see if I could see any people that might have got off the boat, maybe visiting neighbors in the area, and there was nobody there. And I knew whoever was in that boat was watching us. All I had to do was walk down the steps from the deck, which we did. We were getting within about 6 feet of it, I swear. I looked up at it, and it was metal, made of metal. There was no windows, no doors, no rails, nothing. But I said, "Carl," and instant I said, "Carl," it took off straight up in the air. All I heard was a very faint hum. There was no other sound. I was stunned. We were all stunned. And when I think back on it, the water wasn't disturbed at all, so it couldn't have been sitting in the water, which is only about 3 feet below the lawn. And all of a sudden, when it circled the bay overhead, there was swish, swish, swish. It seemed like small airplanes in the dark. They were just dark forms. In fact, when these things swished over our heads, the men were tall men. They ducked too. I ducked, I know. It was so close, but this swish, and that's just as fast as I could see it. That's how fast they traveled. Swish, swish, swish. And they went behind the island, which was about 1,000 feet away from our house. And the lights went out. There was no more. Period. We went to the bingo. And the people in the lineup waiting for cards were talking about these planes or whatever it was. And a couple of women had been coming down Curve Lake Road into the village to the bingo. And she said, "Oh, it was just a helicopter. It followed us all the way down Curve Lake Road." I said, "It was no helicopter. You'd hear if it was a helicopter." That was the end of that. Next morning, my neighbor, Gwen, she was going out to see if she could see any signs in the bay, and I followed her out, and there was this big area around, I think, 15, 20 feet, maybe, where all the bulrushes, the tall grasses were down. I phoned the newspaper, and they said they'd had other calls in. They wanted to know if there was a power station near me. And I said, I didn't know. Anyway, they thanked me for calling. And that was the last I heard of it. It bothered me for a couple of weeks after that. I was depressed. When I went to Toronto to visit my daughter, I told them about it, and they said there was an address out in the west end of Toronto which you could write to report anything. So I did, and my son, he's a commercial artist, he drew a picture of it as I told him what it looked like and sent it in to these people. And they said they would get back to me. Never heard him. I was stunned. We were all stunned. I didn't think of UFOs or anything else. To me, it was a boat, and it still is a boat.
Well, I don't need you hanging around my door, trying to drag me down to the shore.
Indeed, on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlock.
There's an interesting little item in the UFO updates list this week, courtesy of the secrecy news, that caught my attention.
It seems that on the 13th of October, a press release was issued by the Director of National Intelligence and the Director of the CIA announcing the creation of a new agency within the CIA called the National Clandestine Service, or NACI, actually, for short. In announcing this new approach, Director Goss said, "The decision to create the NCS at CIA underscores CIA's proud position as the center of gravity for human in our intelligence community. No agency has greater skill and experience in this difficult, complex, and utterly vital discipline of intelligence." Goss added, "The announcement represents a grant of trust and an expression of confidence in CIA from the President, the DNI, and our partners throughout government." So let's see. The FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the IC, and now the NCS. E-I-E-I-O. It amazes me that any one country requires such a large quantity of intelligence-gathering agencies. But how does all this tie into UFOs, you might ask? Well, it's a well-documented fact that elements of the FBI, CIA, and although not yet completely proven, I'm sure the NSA, have conducted investigations into UFO sightings and reports and have compiled data about them. Now, through the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, several ufologists have managed to secure a number of CIA and FBI paperwork concerning what they know about UFOs. However, what is interesting with FOIA requests is that the information gleaned from them is not as important as the information that could not be obtained. It seems the CIA has a bad habit of losing files or pages from reports, and what might be an interesting piece of information suddenly becomes an incomplete document because of lost pages. They really should examine their hiring practices if their file clerks can lose important files so easily. And apparently, the CIA is not the only agency afflicted with losing important documents or parts of documents, because according to reports, the FBI has also released some files with missing pages. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but these agencies are the ones that gather, correlate, and compile bits and pieces of things to get an overall picture of what is going on in the world. That means they have to gather everything, no matter how small, in order to determine if some kind of threat exists or not regarding anything. So how is it that agencies with such delicate and all-encompassing responsibilities find it so easy to lose files and pages of files, aka data, when even the smallest shred of data could prove to be the ultimate link in a chain to be able to determine what is going on? Incidentally, HUMINT, it stands for Human Intelligence versus Electronic Intelligence. And according to intelligence gathering agencies, HUMINT is the most important and accurate gathering tool they have available. The latest announcement of the creation of a new intelligence agency within the CIA that will be integral to HUMINT means that supposedly residents of the USA will have superior intelligence gathering capabilities. Now, the only question is, will they be able to properly file and keep track of everything that they get their hands on? That's just my take on it.
Dave Berlant, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
FBI, CIA, FOIA, MOUSE.
You got it. E-I-E-I-O. Alphabet soup.
Yes, it's really astounding how much paperwork actually goes missing.
Oh,
it's not just the intelligence agencies, it's the non-intelligence agencies, like government departments, you know? Mm-hmm.
I mean, where are they hiring these file clerks from?
I don't know.
You know, is that a requirement of the job? You have to be able to lose pages?
Especially when files are taken out of secret stashes of documents,
mm-hmm.
there's a dozen places to sign for those, and when they're taken back, the receiver signs for every one of those pages in that folder.
Uh-huh. It's sort of like, oh, well, yeah, you take that out. Oh, don't worry about bringing it back.
Just throw it away. It's fine.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's cool.
We don't need that. We didn't need to gather that in the first place.
Exactly. It's scary is what it is.
It is. And I sure do believe they lose all those documents, too.
Oh, of course they do. We know they do. They've got to lose those. I mean, what other reason could there be?
Well, look at all the documents from Roswell, the
mm-hmm.
Roswell Army Air Force Base.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, we lost a lot of documents. Right around that time, too, we were just buckets full of documents just disappeared.
Mm-hmm. All the stuff before and after. Oh, yeah, we've got that.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, we know that the nurse didn't exist because she doesn't appear on the records that we have from exactly that time period.
Yeah, exactly.
Not that I really believe that there was a nurse around at that time anyway, but you understand what I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yes.
Allegedly a witness to the bodies that were recovered
exactly.
outside of Roswell, New Mexico, the nurse.
Yeah, the one who told the...
red-haired... Captain.
Undertaker. And
the Undertaker.
Yes, red-haired
yeah.
Captain
the red-haired
is the
captain.
Other guy.
Yes.
He also doesn't exist according to the...
Well, how would they know? Documents. The documents from the Army Air Force Base there disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any records, so how would they know whether he existed or not?
That's the interesting thing. It's not so much what we have to read out of these documents. It's what we're not allowed to read that's been lost or misplaced or what have you.
Yeah,
now we have to start wondering.
And thank you for that. It was excellent.
Cool.
Good night, Dave.
Good night.
There's a bug in my brain and it's driving me insane. There's a bug in my mind of an alien kind. All the riders are wrong and the wrong is the right. Gotta act, get them back. Am I losing my track? The last will be first and the first will be last. I got a bug in my mind of an implant kind. Got a bug in my mind of an implant kind.
Bill Boucher has been an occasional contributor to the UFO Updates list, speaking on behalf a lot of the time of the John Mack Institute. And here, as it was then, Bill Boucher was an assistant at the John Mack Institute. Will, after Dr. John Mack was tragically killed in London by a drunk driver, spent his remaining time at the John Mack Institute digitizing all of the archives that had been put together around John Mack. And he is now down in a little tiny city in New Mexico. It's amazing the number of people that are down there in Albuquerque in New Mexico. Joining us on the line from down there is Will Boucher.
I am indeed. I'm on the road. my eventual destination is hopefully Boulder, Colorado. But
Boulder, Colorado.
For a couple months, I'm holed up in this semi-desert city. Very nice place.
It is. It's a lovely place. My memory of it is a lot of stucco and a lot of nice sort of high desert colors there, pinks and oranges and yellows. And
it surely is. It's a good change from Cambridge. I loved my time there, but I never got used to the snow.
Yeah, it's amazing how small Albuquerque is, but that's where Wendy Connors lives and Richard Hoagland is down there, and a few others, too, live in that small city. It's good for you, I guess, to take a break from all of the apparent strangeness and a very different lifestyle that happened for you in Cambridge, huh?
Well, that's true. I mean, most of my friends who I met at the John Mack Institute, or the experiencers who worked with John, you know, many of them have retreated to private life. You know, they've moved on to other parts of the country. But even after John's death, you know, I remained working for his family, as you say, scanning in over 10,000 of his letters and essays and manuscripts in development. And that was a very good way to sort of do the grieving process.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to move away from it, but something is drawing me back, and that something is Susan Clancy's latest book, Abducted, yeah. How People Come to Believe They Were Kidnapped by Aliens.
I think that the majority of people who have an opinion on the book actually haven't read it, but I understand that you have a copy of it.
I actually got a copy of it about a week before it was published. I have to admit, I did not read it all the way through until this afternoon, and fortunately it's under 200 pages. I read it while eating lunch. So. And I'd encourage everyone who's near a bookstore, who's interested in reading the book, go ahead, check it out.
Most people who would be inclined to read it, that listen to this program, would probably end up hurling it against the wall.
Exactly.
You were somehow peripherally involved with Susan Clancy while she was doing the research for this book?
Yeah, that's true. The origins of both Susan Clancy's research and, well, she was a doctoral student of another name you might recognize, Richard McNally, the two Harvard-trained people who really have a rather opposing view of alien encounters compared to John Mack. But I met them through the John Mack Institute. It was back in 99, in fact, where they were looking for experience or subject, and they were having a very difficult time finding any, and they contacted our organization. So John Mack said to me, we'll try to get some of the experiencers I've worked with, see if any of them want to volunteer. And so I manned the phones, trying to round up a few, but it's very difficult because not many people really want to participate in these sorts of research. So finally I said, well, you know, they're having such a hard time finding anybody. I'm just up the street. I'm an experiencer myself. I'll help them out.
Mm.
So I actually met them, you know, several years ago. Fortunately, I was spared being in this book. I think I appear in like one or two sentences, which is fine with me.
Can we go back to the nature of your experience or experiences and then come back to Susan Clancy again?
Sure.
What got you?
Yeah, what got me? I mean, my experiences tend to be of the more surreal nature. I try to advocate the possibility that these alien encounters are more of an interdimensional type phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
At least they appear that way to me. I think that perhaps being in the suburbs rather decreased the chances of saucers landing in the backyard and so forth. But it didn't stop just the general appearance of beings in my environment. And so for years, I just had to consider the possibility that these were just some sort of illusions or dreams, since they tended to be at night. But over the course of many years, it just built and built to the point where it had such a structured narrative that I had to take it seriously. And that's pretty much when I got involved with John Mack's organization. I had intellectually come to the conclusion that it was a strong possibility that alien visitations were actually occurring.
Did these, in the same way that Susan Clancy talks about dream state abductions happening while the subjects are in bed,
sleep paralysis, hypnagogic
state, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were your experiences like that, or were they more like the John Velez, where, you know, within a few yards of his house, he sees this object overhead, and suddenly it's many hours later?
Yeah.
I mean, John is walking down the street or running terrified from this thing that he's seen in the sky above him.
Well, I sometimes envy those people who have that kind of confirmation. I think if I had that kind of hardcore experience, it would probably be very disturbing, because as emotionally close as you get to this experience, as much as you feel you've accepted it, every time something happens, it renews that sense of terror and just absolute amazement that something is actually occurring. No, my experiences have mostly just been with beings who have appeared in my room, sort of telepathic communication. I often am waking up from the experience, but it's not the sort of transitory state where you're in between waking and sleeping. You know, I become fully conscious. I've held these beings' hands. I've looked at their clothing. I've looked at their cheekbone of their face. Enough details, all recalled consciously. This isn't stuff that's been brought forth via hypnosis. I did at one point try Reiki, and during a Reiki session, I had a vivid sort of reliving of the emotional intensity of some earlier experiences. But even if I hadn't had that, my point of view is very similar to John Mack's in terms of the way these experiences affected me is what's most meaningful to me. It's not so much a question of, oh, what planet are they from? It's that they've completely redefined my concept of what reality is.
And I guess in a certain way have reshaped your brain in some way too, huh?
Well, this is exactly a part that Clancy actually gets right in her book. She has in the concluding chapter of her book, she discusses the spiritual impact. And her observations are really not that dissimilar from those of John Mack. She has this quote I'd like to read for you. She says, during the experiment, something happened that I didn't anticipate. All of the subjects reported that the most traumatic experiences in their lives were abduction-related. That was no surprise. But some of them also reported that their most positive life experiences were abduction-related as well. All of the subjects, without exception, said they felt changed by their experiences. People went so far as to say, I'd be a much different person if I hadn't been abducted. I would have led a much emptier, drier existence. She concludes that being abducted by aliens is a transformative event. And that was completely the truth for me. You know, I was raised without any sort of sense of religious traditions, which typically teach that there's both a material level of the world and what theologians dub the spiritual part of the world.
Mm.
Now, when you have beings appearing, you know, from thin air, it's very suggestive of the kind of visits that in the old days one might have accounted as being visits from angels or from spirits or whatever can come from that so-called spiritual realm. But I think we're probably coming to a point where the so-called spiritual realm will eventually be redefined as other dimensions.
Mm.
You know, we may be decades away from that, but I think that's where we're headed. So Clancy's book actually gets it quite right in that she realizes that when people have these experiences, it sort of breaks open their worldview. It makes them redefine their concept of reality. It bonds them, in a sense, to the concept that other life is part of our extended family. But the difference between her and Mac is that Mac said, yeah, these are amazing insights that are all happening because these beings are provoking us towards this realization. Clancy, on the other hand, says that, no, these are all just the sort of pat stories a person tells themselves in order to find meaning in a meaningless world.
Hmm.
It's the kind of cynicism which is rife among skeptics, and it's sad to see a person like Clancy expressing it, but she has decided that she's only going to accept things that have hardcore scientific proof, and tragically that leaves out the entire range of alien encounter experiences which people are having.
And she restricted her field of view as far as abductees were concerned too, it seems. Has your thinking changed about life, the universe, and everything as a result of your experiences?
Absolutely. It sure has. Unfortunately, all the sort of revelation that I've gotten from my experiences, you know, ties into what Clancy would say is just a symptom of people's need to find meaning in the universe.
But you weren't looking for meaning in the universe.
No, sometimes it just kind of comes up and grabs you.
Yeah, well, yeah, it bites you on the bum, as I recall.
But the sense of these aliens being sort of related to oneself, it's a fascinating area that I think is kind of misunderstood. Sometimes people hear that people think they're related to the aliens, and they think that they mean biologically. And there may be some people who feel that, but the sense that I got from it was the concept that all sentient life, all life that has souls, is, in a sense, family. And I think although people can get that sort of feeling if, say, swim with dolphins or do other similar things, for me, it was the contact with these beings that really deepened that for me. This is also something that ties into research done not only by Clancy, but also by Richard McNally, and more recently by Christopher French, all three skeptics. In studying the personalities of experiencers, both here and in the UK, what they found is that experiencers have a greater degree of a personality quality called absorption. And absorption is essentially the ability to feel that one becomes one with an experience. That sort of connection is symptomatic of that personality trait. So what fascinates me about the personality studies of these people, despite the fact that these people are skeptics and saying these experiences aren't true, it's still there is the possibility that they may be correct, that the minds of experiencers may be a little bit different than average, a little bit more sensitive to forming that sort of connection to other life. And so I think when we criticize books by Clancy and McNally and French, we shouldn't throw out all their research, because some of it might imply that there are particular qualities that people could develop to have better communication with these beings, or it may be that there's particular portions of the population that are more able to communicate with these beings, so perhaps that might reveal why aliens abduct some people and not others. You know, many different possibilities arise from their discovery of these personality traits, none of which are explored in her book, of course.
It seems to me that there are two types of people who've been through what they've been through. There's the experiencer type, like yourself, and to be honest with you, Will, you don't sound particularly traumatized by your experiences. And then on the other hand, we have the abductees represented by John Velez and a lot of the people who are in the documentary Touched.
Sure.
By Laurel Chaitin, who were traumatized and have never been the same since. And there really has not been a lot of growth in their life. You know, the only thing that's grown in their lives is the terror of the threat and the confusion and the bewilderment.
First, I should apologize to anyone who feels that I may be dismissing the terror.
No, I don't think you are. What I wanted to do was for the people out there who are hearing this kind of discussion for the first time is to point out what it is that I see going on out there. And it seems that Susan Clancy, in her book, which is Abducted, How People Come to Believe They Were Kidnapped by Aliens, has only dealt with the experiencer side of all of this and those who were taken from their beds during the course of their experience, and they haven't dealt with the abductees, the people who were driving home and were only a half an hour from home after a five-hour drive, you know, suddenly came to in their car again after they'd seen this craft and a beam of light came down at them. It was 3 hours later, and they were 150 miles back up the road that they'd come down, going in the opposite direction to their home. So the Susan Clancy's, the McNally's, and the French's haven't dealt with that side of this phenomenon.
It's true. Their sample is rather skewed because they were seeking volunteers. They were seeking people who apparently familiar enough with their experiences to be able to articulate their experiences to these people. So if the people that they spoke to as they were recruiting were still very traumatized by their experience and at a loss for words to even describe the horrors they had gone through, they probably didn't come across as stable, and perhaps they were omitted. I have to say that Clancy seems to cover a pretty broad spectrum of experiencers in her book, people that she recruited through newspaper ads. And many of these people are very, very troubled by it. Thanks for saying I sound well-adjusted now, but you know, it was a several-year process for myself to reach this point.
Yeah, you sound very at peace with that whole experience now. I don't know what you were like a few years ago.
Yeah, it was terrifying at first. I mean, not being able to sleep with the lights off, of course, losing weight, feeling absolutely bewildered, searching for explanations. That is part of it. You know what really helped me, frankly, was being in an environment of the office of John Mack. Now, bear in mind, I was not one of his clients. I wasn't in therapy with John Mack. But simply being around people who credited these experiences as possibly real, that sort of sense of community does let one come to terms with their experience, and it helped me move beyond the fear. It helped me face the fear. It helped me see other people around me who had been through it and who had survived and who had turned out rather well.
And did you end up working for John Mack as a result of your experiences, or did your experiences come as a result of working for John Mack?
My experiences came first. I actually started out working for him transcribing some of his clinical sessions. I'd been doing some temp work typing. That's how I was first introduced to their organization, was just typing up the clinical sessions that he recorded. And at some point, I was invited in to work at the office. It was all rather serendipitous for myself.
Yeah,
isn't
that somewhat synchronistic that you go through what you go through and you end up working with one of the leading researchers on the subject?
It was fantastic. I disagreed with John Mack on a few points, but the general philosophy that he had was one that I shared. So it was a terrific growing experience for me.
Did you learn anything during the course of your experiences, Will Boucher? And not necessarily about yourself, but something external to you?
Well, there was a time when I tried to ask, sort of in meditation, for more information about these gray beings to try to get a sense of what their motivations were.
These were gray beings, huh?
That's typically what they're called.
Yes.
My own experience, they were a little bit more bone white, sometimes beige.
Mm-hmm.
Once one was very pink. Yeah, the typical kind of beings.
Beings with a large almond-shaped eyes.
Yeah, and sometimes they have the heavier kind of, I call them babushka-type escorts, which are much bulkier and seem to do the heavy lifting. In a meditation, I tried to learn more about what their history was, what their reason was for being here, why they were interacting. And I got information which personally was satisfying to me, but I don't know what to do with it. Was it simply my imagination satisfying my curiosity? Was it their true history? Was it some sort of mythology which is symbolically real? You know, the difficulty with communicating with these beings is that, at least in my experience, they don't speak English. They're speaking in highly theatrical concepts. Even some of the interaction which they have with people seems to be more theater than for any practical purpose. I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that many men report having sperm extracted as part of the so-called hybrid project. At least they were up until around 99 or 2000. And yet, many people also describe having sort of intimate encounters of a sexual nature with an alien being, which wouldn't seem necessary if the process is purely mechanical and medical. The way I view these types of situations is the possibility that the beings are trying to communicate with us theatrically. They're trying to drive home the point that two species are coming together. They're coming together in a reproductive way and in an emotional type of bonding way. They're having to overcome a massive language barrier, and so they're doing so as best they can. Unfortunately, the high theater of it is also why people like Susan Clancy can view it all as metaphor, because, you know, of course, the best art works on many levels. So I don't think there's any sure way to convince skeptics that these experiences are real. It's up to people like us to credit the possibility that they're real and to try to learn as much as we can in our interactions with these beings. And when people are having terror in these experiences, I would hope that some of the guidance that they get might involve ways to ease the fear when an experience is actually taking place. For myself, when I learned meditation, I was able to slow my heart rate. So when an experience started up, I was able to be calm. I was able to remember the fact that I'm typically returned, apparently unharmed. And that changed everything for me. You know, I don't want to cause problems for this situation. I want to be in a situation of equality where I can communicate with the being and she or he can communicate with me. But until that point, the best I can do is just to be as calm, to try to listen, to try to remember as much as I can. And that's not easy. You know, that takes a lot of work. But I have to add that looking over the course of my life, the experiences I've had, I've seen very many efforts to communicate to me symbolically about the general concept of what's going on. It's true they don't arrive and say, okay, this is exactly what's happening. But even when I was a child and they were simply introducing themselves to me, they did so in as gentle a process as possible. And I think they try to acclimatize people so that we can overcome our fear. I think that the stakes are so high regarding the life between two separate species that we may have to sacrifice some of our personal freedoms for a greater good. We do that when we donate blood. We do that if to save another race, maybe save both of our race.
Will Boucher, I want to thank you for joining us. I know you don't do a lot of radio, and pleased that you decided to be with us.
Oh, thank you, Errol.
Good night, Will Boucher.
Most people think God will come from the sky, take away everything, make everyone high. But if you know what life is worth, you'll look for yours right here on earth. So now you see the light, stand up for your right.
Don't give up, don't give up.
Stand up for your right.
Get up,
stand up for your right.
It's always a pleasure to introduce our next guest. He's been a regular contributor to this program for many years. I'm referring, of course, to Richard Hall. After serving the fledgling U.S. Air Force, Richard Hall enrolled at Tulane University in New Orleans in 1954. Originally a mathematics major, he tired of that discipline and switched to a major in philosophy and a minor in mathematics. And then, attracted by emerging news about sightings of flying saucers in the 1950s, he opted to make himself available to the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP, which was then being formed. After working for NICAP for about 10 years, Dick Hall resigned to find honest, i.e. paying work, because of impending marriage. And for a number of years afterward, he worked for various trade associations in Washington, D.C., and for some Beltway Bandit consulting firms as a writer-editor. And his final formal job before semi-retirement was as an abstractor indexer at Congressional Information Service in Bethesda, Maryland, for about 10 years. Richard Hall served as chairman of the Fund for UFO Research from 1993 to 1998, and is the author of several books, including The UFO Evidence and The UFO Evidence Volume 2, a 30-year report, and Uninvited Guests, all of which you can get to via this week's program listing. There's an odd footnote here. He's also a founding member of the Church of Equine Velocity and holds the title of Magister Velocitatis Equini. I didn't think you were ever a horse-type person, Richard Hall.
I'm not a horse-type person, but I am interested in watching them run.
There we go. That explains the Latinus. So you, despite being semi-retired, have been a busy man.
Indeed, yes. I keep very strongly occupied. All kinds of hobbies and interests and activities in addition to UFOs.
And UFOs are, I guess, a frustrating part of your life at the moment, huh?
Well, they've been a frustrating part of my life for most of my life, actually. It's been very hard to see any measurable progress by most measurements, but I've hung in there and worked hard to try to help bring the thing out to the public and get serious attention to it. Although I'm having to spend more time on other topics these days, I still have a very strong interest and I still stay involved, particularly with my Journal of UFO History.
And I was going to come to that, and I should have done it in the intro to you, the Journal of UFO History, which you have been publishing for, what, 3 or 4 years now?
Well, actually, I'm in the third year, that's right. It's the third year because it's a volume per year, and I'm working on volume 4 now, so I'm starting my fourth year, actually.
And people can subscribe to that via your website, hallrichard.com.
Yes, all the information is on there.
The Journal of UFO History is, as its title suggests, a history of UFOs and a look back, presumably, at the really good cases that you have come across in your years as a UFO researcher.
Yes, I do have, in just about every issue, chronologies and featured case histories, but I also get into the political developments and background and twists and turns of the subject in other respects, too.
When I said earlier on the frustration of UFOs, I have a list of words that I would like to throw at you. The first on the list is the new ufology.
I'm not sure what that is, but the new ufology, if I understand the meaning, is very much unlike the old ufology, which I guess you can characterize me as being an old ufologist in more senses than one. It used to be much more simple and straightforward. There were these funny things flying around and being tracked and photographed and detected on radar, leaving physical traces and all that. And then somewhere along the line, when the U.S. Air Force got out of it and scientists began ignoring it, then things went sort of haywire and more weird types of reports started coming in. And it's just in a terrible state of confusion, in my estimation, these days.
It seems to me that in the last years, things like Bigfoot and crop circles have crept in under the umbrella of ufology.
And cattle mutilations and anything else puzzling and mysterious. The Bermuda Triangle, and there are people that throw in just about every other mystery. Let's face it, there are all kinds of fascinating mysteries in the world, but there's no reason whatsoever to think they're all interrelated and or all due to aliens or whatever either. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Just, to me, sloppy thinking.
So you would dismiss crop circles?
No, I think several of those, and especially crop circles, are very intriguing mysteries. But all I'm saying is there's no reason to assume they're somehow connected with UFOs. The direct link is very slender. I know there are one or two photographs purporting to show something flying around at the time one of these crop circles appeared, and of course there are lots and lots of hoaxes which muddy up the waters, and,
yes,
or stir up the grain fields, however you want to put it. But it's hard to pin down reliable information even about crop circles, but to make a link, I think, is somewhat uncritical. I'm all for thorough investigation of such things. Weed out the hoaxes, mm-hmm, just like you have to do with UFOs, and pin down, is there a real mystery here? And I think there's suggested evidence, especially by people like Dr. Levengood's outfit, of something mysterious going on there. And it's not that easy to explain it away as all hoaxes. But I just don't see it as being related to UFOs necessarily. It's one of those things that Stan Friedman would put in his gray basket.
Yes. How about alien abductions? Are you intrigued by that situation?
Oh, indeed. I have been deeply personally involved in investigations and in helping to run conferences on the subject. I was on the board of the group that prepared the abduction conference at MIT several years back. I've participated in ones at Temple University and Fairfield, Connecticut, and here in my own county, Prince George's County of Maryland, and all over the place. And I was deeply involved in personal investigations for a long time. And talk about frustrating, yes. It's very hard to pin anything down or get any really concrete, objective evidence. People will make the case that, yes, there is some, but it hasn't really been thoroughly vetted or documented all that well.
Speaking of documentation, there don't seem to be as many reports of abduction as there have been over the last 20 years.
Yeah, well, that's another one that's hard to keep track of. You know, the issue arises, how frequently are good UFO reports being made? I have to say good UFO reports because you get trivial ones all the time, people mistaking meteors and things like that. But in other words, are the real genuine articles still being reported? And yes, they are, but they're much harder to get at except through sites like Peter Davenport's website. And even a lot of those cases are not really investigated. They're just raw data, raw unchecked reports that come in, which are fascinating and interesting. But see, you can see the lacking feature all the way through here is good, thorough, on-the-ground investigation.
And that seems to be a complaint of many UFO researchers, is because of the emergence of the web as a reporting source, there are less and less people getting that kind of information, where local MUFON chapters at one time would get a lot of UFO reports and would have a raft of investigators able to go out and look into those reports.
Yes, and another thing that's involved here, how can we get at this better? Well, let's take the example last November of the disc-shaped object that hovered over O'Hare Airport in Chicago. The big problem right away, which NARCAP, the pilot sighting group, ran into, was a bunch of amateurs and curiosity seekers, everybody rushing in and harassing the witnesses, basically. I mean, that wasn't their intent to harass them, but that's what it amounts to. And making it difficult for the serious hardcore investigators to get anywhere. Now, this, in turn, is a symptom of something I've given a lot of thought to. The big thing that's lacking today is a dominant organization or agency that commands a sufficient respect that they get primary attention. And they can call up when a sighting happens and say, hey, we're interested, we want to come there, we want to talk to you, want to gather all the evidence, try to get to the bottom of this, and they preempt the other curiosity seekers and so forth. Now, in the O'Hare case, it was very important that one reporter had curiosity and dug into it himself. That was very important.
Yes.
Very important factor in the whole thing. But then he needs help from that point because he's a newspaper reporter. He's not an expert on the issues involved necessarily. He might be to some degree, but anyway, the problem is the lack of a central, strong organization like we used to have at NICAP, and MUFON in its heyday had sufficient respect that it could get in on the ground floor of sightings and so forth. Now, I don't know the solution to this. Membership organizations are passe, because partly because of the web, because anybody can just click on and look up all kinds of wild and hairy stories to their heart's content, and they're totally unvetted for the most part. It just complicates things. The web obviously is a mixed blessing in all respects when it comes to UFOs and other topics, too.
I imagine that various parts of the federal government got severely harassed after the John Hillkovich article in the Chicago Tribune at the beginning of this year. And most of those were probably amateurs and came off somewhat idiotically.
Yes. That's another thing that when the UFO community, for lack of a better term, starts endless speculation like it does, endless theorizing, how many angels can stand on the head of a pin kind of thing, and gets far removed from empirical facts. And any scientist who gets a little curiosity starts using the internet and looks on, he's going to see a bunch of crazy, wild speculation. It's going to turn him off, most likely, unless he's had a personal sighting or something that he knows enough to go past that and look at the serious people. But but there is a great deal of bad reputation that the UFO community as a whole has, and that's why I disown a great deal of the UFO community. I don't want to be recognized as part of them.
Yeah, and that's understood, and presumably that's why Richard Haynes took NARCAP the way he has with unidentified aerial phenomena.
Yes, and NARCAP is a group that has excellent contacts in the aviation community, obviously, and the scientific community. Dick's a good hardcore scientist himself. And these are the people that you want to see get on top of a case like O'Hare. But a lot of the people that jump into the picture, it's understandable. They're personally curious. They want to know what happened, so they start making phone calls and sending emails or going in person or whatever. But so are a bunch of other people at the same time, and it just gets out of control after a while.
And I guess there's really no solution to that situation either, huh?
Not unless there's some way to get a what I'm going to call a dominant agency, dominant organization. And it could be at a government agency. I'm not specifying whether it be civilian or government, but if we had a president of the United States that came along, for example, and said, I want to start up a continuing study group, it doesn't have to buy into, he or she, I should say, doesn't have to buy into aliens or anything else. It's just an interesting ongoing phenomenon. It's highly controversial, but it's affected a lot of people. Let's just monitor it. Let's just have an ongoing study group. Now, something like that could jump in and make a huge difference. But otherwise, it would come down to the private sector, and that gets problematical because they're always looking at the bottom line of profit, and that's unlikely to be possible.
There have been some big money people involved who put their own money into assisting in UFO research.
Yes,
over the years.
Right, notably Robert Bigelow, but he's tired of the subject too and gone off to other things primarily. So you can see the problem there, though. Somebody like Bigelow had grand designs to jump in and make a huge difference in a short time by throwing money around, and that just didn't work. Then you get into the whole discussion that is going on right now about what would you do if you had the money? I mean, how would you get a better investigation done? Well, I have some ideas on that. In the first place, there is a major myth in people looking at the UFO field say there's nothing really concrete there to investigate. I say nonsense. There is plenty of hardcore type evidence to investigate, and that includes, of course, physical traces, radar tracking, photographs, all the rest of it. Objects that punch holes in clouds as they accelerate above O'Hare Field. I mean, you can go on and on. Things that are there to investigate. Now, I was asked today, as a matter of fact, by somebody on the internet, assume you have the money, how would you spend it to get a serious investigation done? Well, okay, I already laid that out in some detail in the UFO Evidence Volume 2. It's in the back section there somewhere about the basic elements of a real scientific investigation, and I can sort of condense it here. It spells out, I forget, 12 or 14 items that scientists could do if they got serious about it and the funding was available. You have to make that assumption because they can't work for nothing. Then here's what could be done, and basically there are two elements to it. One is gather all the historical information of the important type case, not just every little scrap and piece of everything everybody reported, but get all the radar cases, trace cases, and that sort of thing. Get all the documentation that's out there that's been put together by various people in one place into a good database. Okay, that lays the groundwork, and this educates the scientists who presumably are working on it by now to what there is to look for there. Okay, now that you need a current data gathering capability to pick up on new cases, and that's where you get into rapid response teams, field investigators, and all this kind of thing. And you have to have a network, a respected network, so that when a UFO is reported, it goes immediately to this federal or private agency, whatever it is, that's sponsoring this study, and get it uniform communications network like that going, and then you can start gathering much better current data. And the end result of all this is going to be something far more approximating a real scientific study than we've ever had. Now, that's the condensed version of my spiel.
And it occurred to me, as you were mentioning Robert Bigelow, Joe Firmage was around for a while, too.
Oh, Joe Firmage, too, yes. He's had his ups and downs financially, and he sort of phased out, too, and he ran into some of the problem of, well, he had grand schemes, too, that may have been a little unrealistic, but he's a very nice fellow, and his heart is certainly in the right place. And,
yes.
But he's phased out, too, of the UFO, as far as I know. I used to be in touch with him fairly regularly, but I think he's moved on to other things, too.
Gone back to making lots of money off the web, I think.
That's probably it, yeah.
Yes.
Which he's very good at. He's good at losing it, too, because he's very idealistic and very generous.
Although I must admit that I haven't personally come across anybody who was funded by Joe Firmage. I heard various rumors, but never had it confirmed.
Well, I know some who were, including me. I was funded by him on one project, and he was very generous in his support.
We need more Joe Firmages and Robert Bigelows,
yeah.
I guess. Yes.
Especially if they are not the kind who are trying to make a big name for themselves and are more modest. There's some wealthy people we used to encounter in the NICAP days said, if you will accept the contactee stories and publicize George Adamski, we'll give you $5 million. And we said, no way. When they have that kind of string attached, you lose interest very rapidly.
I would say, yes. Too bad that the people who were offering that money were just so blinkered or just so open-minded to the crazies out there.
Yes.
And too bad that the offer was made to people who just must have been gnashing their teeth.
Yes. Well, there was another fellow, William Henry Belk of the Belk department stores, and based in North Carolina, I believe, or were in those days. He was another one very interested in wanting to support, but he had all his pet projects and interests. And then, of course, more recently, it was Rockefeller who got involved. So the people have been there, but they've tended to have their own axes to grind and their own private interests they want to promote, rather than what I would call a more objective, sweeping scientific study.
Do you think it's likely that someone will come along who has the funds to be able to set up an organization along the lines that you suggest? Because ideally, you need very few, in quotes, ufologists in that organization, and a lot of different types of scientists who are adept and very much above the norm in their own particular fields.
Well, I don't think it's very likely to happen for the reason I said, that the people who have the money and the interest usually have their own personal axes to grind.
Oh, what would it take to get a United States government department interested in
it? I don't know that either. That's that would depend entirely on getting the right sort of president that had an interest and the courage to do it, because you have to face all the ridicule and everything. But the minute real serious research money got into the picture, then that would get rid of a lot of the ridicule, because there is a scientific underground. We all know that, who are involved in the field, because we're in touch off and on with the scientific underground, so to speak. And it's there, and there are lots of scientists who would love to do work on this, but first they got to get over the ridicule factor, and they got to get serious research money.
It's a pity that there isn't anyone with the connections who could approach a lot of these people very quietly behind the scenes with no publicity at all and have them go at it for a couple of years.
Well, I can only hope that I'm gradually passing the torch to a new generation, and I've also advocated approaching, for example, university science departments contact the chairman of the physics department. Astronomy really isn't that relevant to UFOs. They're focused off in deep space somewhere, but atmospheric scientists and physicists of that types that are concerned with near-Earth things, challenge them. Say, we would like to come to your department and you get your professors around and we would like to give you a private off-the-record briefing, no publicity, about the real serious hardcore UFO data. And knowing that they're skeptical, you go prepared to deal with that. And I've even written out scenarios and ideas on how you could go about this. And that would be one way of perhaps getting somewhere. Because if they begin to see the hardcore evidence, which they're not seeing now, they're seeing the noise, they're seeing all the craziness, then they might start making some inquiries. And a lot of these people have contacts in government and in well-funded agencies and so forth, and they can start talking it up among themselves and perhaps get something going. Of the options of a private industry type or a government agency type or this approach, I think this approach is more realistic and would have a better chance of getting somewhere.
I'm thinking what a waste Paul Hellyer was, the former Canadian defense minister, who would actually have been an ideal front man if he had been briefed in the right way.
Yeah, discriminating type.
Yes, I mean, all of his interest was deeply rooted in the book by former Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso.
Yes.
The people that he got hooked up with, largely regarded as unreliable in the UFO field, is really a tragedy.
Yes. Well, the whole thing, yeah, it's a gigantic mess. The only comparatively simple solution, if you want to call it a solution, or a start on a solution would be, and I insist, you require some kind of an organization or agency, a dominant one that has clout and influence. Now, recently we had the sci-fi group come in and also start throwing some money around, but...
And they're still actually grinding it out.
Yeah, they're grinding it out.
Yeah, I was talking with Leslie Kane last week or the week before, and she and Bud Hopkins, who's in much better health now, were on their way back when Leslie called me on a train from Washington to New York. And they had just been in Washington to appear before a judge who was not happy with NASA and castigated the NASA lawyer for NASA dragging its feet in releasing FOIA-requested documents on the Kecksburg incident.
Yes, I knew she was still digging on that front. Mm-hmm. But the problem, again, with the sci-fi people is their bottom line is money-making, and I participated in their meetings here in Washington before, a few years back, but they're looking for program material, basically, and the ongoing sponsorship. I understand that some of the ownership or management changed there, and there's not as much potential support as there was at one point, but I hope that's wrong, because I thought their Roswell dig was a good idea, to go down and do an archaeological dig by a trained archaeologist at the alleged landing, or one of the alleged landing sites. That was a good move.
I don't recall seeing anything coming out of that dig.
Oh, yes. They published a report.
The last I'd heard, they had all these bags of dirt in a bank vault somewhere.
Oh, well, maybe you're right. They just put out a preliminary report. They hadn't finished analyzing everything, but yeah. But anyway, it wasn't a bad idea.
It was a great idea.
Yeah, but again, I have my doubts about sci-fi, and I have my doubts about any corporate entity that gets into it, because they obviously are out for one thing. I've worked for corporations.
As have I, yes.
I know how they operate.
Yes, as you said, the bottom line every time.
Yep.
On the subject of television, how do you feel about TV documentaries nowadays?
Oh, boy. That's the wrong button to push.
I asked that question ducking beneath the microphone.
Yeah, I think they're horrible. With one or two or three rare exceptions, I've gotten to the point where people keep telling me there's going to be a documentary on Discovery or some channel or National Geographic or whatever, and I just say thanks and goodbye, and I don't even bother to watch it. I've really gotten that cynical about it. I have seen along the way in the past, let's say, 5 or 8 years, maybe 2 or 3 pretty decent documentaries, and what that comes down to is not the broadcast company, it's the independent producers.
Yes.
Because they just buy things by independent producers, and they're rather undiscriminating about it. All they're, again, they're interested in entertainment. That's what they want, entertainment.
Yes.
And so you get a lot of junk on there, and I just wince every time I look at one of those, and they start flashing, obviously, fake photographs and camera errors and lens flares and this stuff as if they were genuine UFOs, and they get all the idiotic people with their wild ideas. I just get totally sick of the whole thing. On the other hand, I have seen one or two that involve people like Mike Swords and Jerry Clark and Mark Roediger and so forth, which were quite well done.
I'm actually quite looking forward to the remake that James Fox is doing on Out of the Blue. I don't know if you saw that.
No, I haven't.
That was a pretty damn good documentary, actually. And the documentary that Canadian filmmaker David Cherniak is doing.
Yes, and who's the other Canadian film guy that's on the UFO Updates list? Kimball.
Paul Kimball.
Yeah, he's working on a very promising one, which he filmed me for. Probably was my last TV. Actually, I made an exception for him because I have declined for several years to do interviews.
Yes.
And for this very reason, I just don't want to be part of the trash that they put out. But Paul convinced me that he was on a good project there, so I went along with that.
There was actually an excellent one on pilot sightings called UFO Black Box, which was quite wonderful because what they did was that they used audio recordings of conversations between pilots and
yes,
control.
I did see all or part of that one, and I was impressed by what
yes,
I saw.
The first half hour of it was literally just graphics,
yes.
Transcripts of what was being said on the soundtrack.
Of course, that's ideal as far as I'm concerned because I'm the empirical guy. I want the facts.
Mm-hmm.
Factual data, let's hear directly from the witnesses, let's document it and so forth. So that's the kind of ones I like.
Yes.
I thought the Peter Jennings one was going to be a lot better than it turned out to be. And
as did most of us.
Part of it was good, and then it just deteriorated into your standard garbagey thing as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, it was almost a headlong rush to get it done. And that's the difficulty. Just looking at the ABC coverage of Fife Symington's outing last week and the week before to do with the Phoenix Lights. And the problem is that none of these broadcast outlets do any research. They just go grab some video footage off the shelf and slap it all together. And with Symington on ABC Good Morning America, they gave the impression that Symington had seen that 10 o'clock flare drop, where in fact he claims that he had seen, along with many hundreds of other witnesses, the various boomerang chevron-shaped objects that were flying around between 7 and 8 in the evening.
Yes. Well, there's another problem that you've touched on, and that's the news media, because the news media are so lacking in independence and vigorous investigative reporting or anything close to that these days, and they believe what the government tells them, incredibly to me, when in other areas they don't trust anything a government person
yes.
says.
Well, it's convenient. Who was it called, Ufology and Inconvenient Truth? Somebody, or maybe they weren't referring to ufology at all.
But the news media are very little help for the most part, and they're a knee-jerk newsreader, and it's often presented as the last humorous item to cheer everybody up, and the newscast, and it's just very, very frustrating. I went on CNN one time on their morning news program, which was live from their studios in Washington, and I don't even remember what the UFO topic was. It was something currently in the news, and I got a skeptical news guy, Paul Himmer, who's now with Fox. He was with CNN then. And he sneered at me and poked and fun at the subject, wrapped it up by saying, well, I think it's all kind of silly, something like that. Very, very rude and crude behavior to a guest to come on and ask him to come on and comment.
And who asked him to editorialize?
Right.
You're an anchor, just present.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So I've had my bad experiences. I was on the NBC Evening News one night being interviewed, and they reported me as Robert Hall instead of Richard Hall. And and in my segment, they played weird woo-woo music, as Wendy Connors would call it, and showed people diving under the desks in the atomic era scare.
Duck and cover, yeah.
Duck and cover and all that kind of stuff. During my segment only, they did this weird music and stuff. And boy, was I furious.
Yes.
That was my pretty much the last straw that this is decided me to get out of that business altogether.
That's the difficulty with doing any form of media, is they can fix things in the edit.
Exactly. That's what I keep telling people. The documentary film people are bad about that too, very often, because like everybody else, they want clever sound bites and not long discussions. And I keep everyone that contacts me, I say, look, get over the sound bite syndrome and get knowledgeable people and let them talk. Sure, edit out flubs and that kind of thing and long-windedness, but I mean, if they're talking cogently about the subject, let them talk, for heaven's sakes. You learn something that way.
And that's the whole intention of this program now, because we're not interrupted by news and commercials, is that we can go as long as we want.
You mean I'm not going to come on your program and just say I hate UFO documentaries?
Well, I could use that clip as a promo, I guess. Favorite case of all time? You've been around what now? The field for 40 years? Even longer.
In which lifetime? I've been around forever. I went up to give a talk a few years back to Bud Hopkins Group in New York City, and I started my little spiel by saying it's not true that I was here at the creation, but almost.
And it's amazing how time flies, isn't it?
I have so many favorite cases. I think probably the ones I lived through and sort of participated in indirectly, I feel very strongly about the Trinidad Isle photographs from Brazil in January 1958, because I was directly involved in pushing for investigation and communicating with the Brazilian embassy and scientists like Dr. Donald Menzel and James McDonald, and urging, you know, study these things, find out what's going on here. So that's one of my favorite cases, and I think the Washington, D.C. radar visual sightings of July 1952 almost single-handedly prove that we're dealing with some intelligence out there.
Yes.
They may not be aliens, they may not be simply from another planet in space, but they sure as hell are not us. They're from somewhere else.
We actually had Frank Fascino on the program last week.
I've got to read the newer book because I hated the original. I thought it was one of the worst books ever published, but I should go on and listen to that interview on the archive.
Yes.
There were gross factual errors, including one that he had Air Force jet interceptors taking off from Keesler Air Force Base, Mississippi, to chase the UFOs in this big aerial combat. Well, I was stationed at Keesler Air Force Base, and it's not a fighter base. It's a training base. It was just pure fiction. And that's the kind of thing that I found. And I checked some of the other bases that he mentioned, and they weren't fighter bases either. So somebody, be it him or his publisher, whoever, his name's on the book, so he's got to take the heat on it.
Yes, and he has done.
But,
considerable
heat, apparently.
There
were gross factual errors in that book.
The reason that I brought Frank Fascino up, along with Stan Friedman, is that Fascino's new book, Shoot 'Em Down, is going to be out in a month or two. And that ties in somewhat neatly to the Washington radar sighting and visual sightings of 1952, because it's all from the same time period.
Yes, it is. But the first book had all that stuff, too. As I say, it's not trustworthy. So I want to listen to that interview and see what's happened there. I'm darned if I'll pay for the book, though, because I just... We'll see. I'm very skeptical of Frank Fascino at this point, but I hope he's improved the book over what it was originally.
According to Frank and Stan, it's a completely new work, so...
Different publisher?
Yes.
Okay. That's a good move, then, if the publisher was tampering with it.
The butcher of wherever they're from. Yeah, all I know is that there were a lot of people unhappy with the book, including yourself, and no one was more unhappy than Frank Fascino.
Well, okay, that's very interesting. I'll keep an open mind, and as I say, I will try to listen to your archive interview there. But the Washington sightings, recently I discovered that there was an interview with Al Chop on the Project 1947 site. They did an oral history of Al Chop, who was the Air Force spokesman at that time, and who was present in the radar room during the famous night when the jet interceptor was surrounded by UFOs, and he was heard to say on the intercom, "They're all around me. What shall I do? What shall I do?" And Chop reports there was dead silence in the radar room because nobody knew what to say. Yes. He comments later in the interview, "What would you tell them? Take two aspirin and call me in the morning?"
Yes. Put your head between your knees and repeat after us.
Duck and cover.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But that's a very fascinating. Al Chop was a very interesting man.
Yes. It was Bob Barrow, I think, on one of the last broadcast programs that I did, who did a synopsis of the film UFO, which was based on Al Chop's life.
Yes, and it included a reconstruction of this case I just mentioned. It showed a radar scope with the UFO surrounding the fighter plane and all that. They reconstructed that in the movie. It was an excellent movie. But it was Bob Barrow who put me in touch with a distant relative of Chop's. So I got some good information coming out in my next journal, a biography and obituary.
I had actually been very tempted to post that interview with Al Chop, and I think I will, for the record, as I do on occasion, put up information from other lists.
I understand they took it down for some reason. I don't know what's going on there, but you can check with them. But I have the transcript, and it's 69 pages. It's quite a long oral history. It's a video.
Yes, and that was one of the reasons I was somewhat loath to put it up, because of the, well, it was Tom Tulin and somebody else, I think, who owned the rights to it.
Yeah, Tom Tulin was involved, and Brad Sparks was involved in the interview. Did put the transcript up on the Project 1947 website.
It was also posted, and I don't recall whether it was actually the email list of Jan Aldrich's Project 1947, or whether it was on Current Encounters, on Francis Ridge's email list. But I know I've got it in my archive here.
Francis, he put it up. He put up a link to it, and then went to check it, and it was gone. It was something. It could have been something temporary.
They got it out of the cache at Google. That's right. What it was.
Right.
I would like to have you on the program more frequently now that you seem to have come out of your ufological retirement.
No, I haven't really come out of my retirement. I just. To say I'm still actively interested, and I don't mind doing programs with you if they're helpful and constructive.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I can educate a few people.
I hope more than a few.
About 10 years ago, people started calling me an elder statesman, and I thought, hey, what's going on here? I'm not that old. Now I consider myself an elder statesman, and I hope I can play some kind of a role in helping to straighten people out a little bit.
I'm sure you will, and I'm sure you have, and thanks to this technology, after we're all long gone, all of our words will continue to echo.
Send them off into space. That'll drive the aliens away.
Yeah, along with James Doohan's ashes, as I saw in the paper, they finally shot him out into space this past week. He got beamed up, Scotty. Richard Hull, I want to thank you for being with us on this program, and look forward to doing it again.
Okay. You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
My thanks to everybody who was on the program this week, Dave Furlott, Will Boucher, and Richard Hull. Thank you for subscribing. And if you have any comments via email, I do listen, I do read, and if you'd like to send an audio file instead of writing, then that would be good. Love to have your audio input. Anything you care to have included in the program is welcome. Eyes to the skies, thank you for being out there. Bye.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.